Hello and welcome to another episode of the Student Loan Planner Podcast. I have got construction happening in the nail salon below me. My wife's working from home and having telehealth meetings with patients. So I'm just going to do my best here. If you hear any noise in the background, we also live next to a hospital and there's all kinds of ambulances passing by all the time, unfortunately. So it's just a weird time. So today we're going to do an episode that kind of reflects the weirdness going on out there. I'm just going to talk about a couple things that have been on my mind. Specifically, we're going to talk about paying nothing on your student loans and why that might be a great idea. And then we're going to talk about borrowing the maximum you possibly humanly can for school. And what does that mean, you know, especially now? And then also, we're going to talk about what this recession means for the future of student loan policy in America and maybe some of the unintended consequences that are going to happen as a result of what Congress did to try to rescue borrowers this time around. And we're going to talk about what this also means for your student loans long term, about some of these policy changes that we might see thanks to some of the efforts that Congress did to help borrowers for this recession. So before I start, just remember that, you know, this episode, this podcast is a lot more fun when you ask questions. So remember to go to studentloanplanner.com/voicemail. And if you go there, you'll be able to press the record button and ask any kind of questions that you have about money, student loans, life, you know, what my favorite Netflix shows are. I mean, not that anybody cares, but, you know, whatever you want to ask about, go ahead and check that URL out to make the show even more fun. So the first thing I want to say is you're seeing a lot of advice out there right now that says that you should not let this opportunity go to waste. You should be paying extra on your student loans, especially federal student loans that have 0% interest rates. And, you know, you can take this opportunity to make sure all that money is going towards principal and not interest. And what a great idea. I have to tell you, my opinion on this is that that is bad advice. And here is why. Think about this for a second. You've got 30 million people that are unemployed, probably even more will be announced in the next report. We're seeing a lot of employers start to strategically lay people off. So for example, our hospital systems here in St. Louis are starting to lay people off because they're just realizing that people are better off on unemployment in some cases than actually on their payroll. And businesses are strategically laying off people who get most of their income replaced with unemployment, making less than $60,000 a year, and then giving pay cuts to maybe other higher paid workers that would be a lot more severely impacted in terms of loss of the percentage of the income they were making before, right? So you're seeing, you know, a lot of physicians taking huge pay cuts at health systems to reflect lower revenue. And then you're seeing people that are not being used for the COVID-19 fighting efforts that might be, you know, in an unrelated field, right? Some sort of elective procedures, nurse that works in elective procedures. A lot of those people are getting furloughed right now because of, you know, just all the chaos. And we're also seeing, you know, a lot of bigger employers finally start putting certain people on unemployment. So things will continue to get worse until they start getting better. And, you know, when will they get better? Either with, you know, maybe all this reopening that's happening, that's people are taking huge risks. State governments are taking huge risks. Some people obviously think that that's irresponsible. Some people support it. But what's going to happen is if that works, then more places are going to do it, right? If you don't see a massive spike in deaths, then more states are going to do that. And then you might start to see an economic recovery. And then maybe paying student loans during this time was an okay idea. But to take the other side of that, what happens if this does not work? What happens if the reopening does lead to even a huge spike in deaths, heaven forbid? And if that does happen, then you're going to see that shutdown happen yet again. And then you're going to see the economy get even worse because even more people would be laid off. And yet, we're still seeing a lot of mainstream media outlets telling people to think like their usual anti-debt, one-size-fits-all advice, which is to pay down your student loans. It's like a broken record. That's the answer to all your problems. Pay down your student loans. So here's a thought. If you put your money in the bank that you were going to put towards your student loans right now, it might only be paying 0.2% interest, but 0.2 is more than zero. If your interest is not growing and your balance is not growing, then any money that would have gone into your loans that you're just keeping in a bank account somewhere, that money is still available to put towards your loans. And you've actually gained money from doing that. It's called arbitrage. It's when you can take your money and invest it at a higher rate than the debt is costing you. And so right now, even bank accounts, as low as the interest is, are still presenting arbitrage compared to using that money and paying it onto the debt. Now, when the money's in your bank account, guess who controls it? You do. So you get control over how much you pull out and what you spend it on. And the unemployment benefits, the expanded unemployment benefits run out in July 31st, right? So maybe the Senate and Congress comes back and they pass something to re-support that program, but maybe it's not as generous. Maybe they don't. And then maybe you lose your job in like mid-June or something unexpectedly, or you have a huge income cut. And then you took $50,000 and you put it on your student loans. Well, in retrospect, that looks like a really bad idea. I think people are sort of overestimating their economic security right now. And people that are making excess payments on their student loans, you know, if you do it, here's a couple things that I would suggest. You want to be employed by the government and probably the federal government, some sort of super safe employer, or just have zero doubt that your income is going to be severely cut. You would want to have expenses that are less than half of what you earn, just in case you get a really large pay cut. You would want to be able to make your payments for at least 2 years out of your emergency savings. And you want to obviously work in the private sector, and your eventual plan is to refinance your loans. And you'd also want to be able to have already maxed out your 401k accounts and have $1,000 a month going into your taxable investment accounts, like in a brokerage account at Vanguard and mutual funds or something like that. So if you're doing all those things, then by all means, you know, sure, fine, pay extra on your student loans if you want to. But I think that people are just vastly overestimating the benefit, and the number of people that are in financial shape to be able to do that, with having that be a good, smart decision, is minuscule compared to the people that are going out and doing that. So this is a great example of why the sort of religious focused idea of paying down debt all the time, no matter what, is not actually good math advice, right? And I don't mean that as in like that's a thing that religious people do, is pay down debt more so than people who are not religious. That's not what I mean. What I mean is, so often people's answers to personal finance are almost like religious answers, in the sense of like, yeah, you know, when you have a faith, you have a faith, you believe in something that can't be proven, but you don't question it because it's, you know, or maybe, I don't know, this is getting kind of off track a little bit, but you get what I'm saying. What I'm trying to say is that something like an anti-debt, Susie Orman, Dave Ramsey kind of mentality about things, or, you know, your aunt or uncle being super anti-debt, a lot of times it acts more like a dogma that should not be questioned versus something that you just ask rational questions of. Does this make sense right now? And I'm just saying that for most people that have federal student loans, it really doesn't make sense right now. Here's another reason. If you have that money in the bank at 0.2% instead of putting it on your federal loans at 0% right now, what happens if the market crashes a bunch? Well, if you put it on your debt, guess what? That's not available for you to be putting it into investments. But if you have it in the bank, and you're otherwise secure financially, and the market fell a bunch, well, then you could put that money into the market and be much better off than if you put it on your debt. On the other side of things, let's say the market soars because they invent some sort of magic cure for coronavirus. So if that happens, you'll still have the debt. You'll still be earning that positive arbitrage on your bank account savings that you could still put towards your loans. So it's a situation where it's like it's a win-win not paying extra on your federal student loans right now. So why do people get told to pay off their loans even during periods of 0% interest? The reason is because of psychology and behavior. I'll just give you an example. My brother works at Disney World. You know, we obviously hope Disney World comes back and employs all the people it used to employ again. So I don't have anything against Disney with this example that I'm going to give, but imagine having young kids and they have saw all the ads on TV and all the product placements and everything. And all they want to do is go to Disney World. It's just their dream to go to Disney World. When it all opens back up, it's safe, all the caveats, you know, appropriate caveats. So they want to do that, but you have to take that $10,000 out of a goal, and you've got two things that you could do. You are looking at paying back your debt, or you're looking at $10,000 that you could have put into the markets, into the stock market or retirement or something like that. So if you're looking at a debt, which feels like a prison, then you're probably going to be a lot more willing to look at your four-year-old in the eye and say, I'm sorry, we're not going to go to Disney because we have, mommy, daddy have to take care of this debt problem that we have. That's just something that's a lot more likely, that you're willing to sacrifice things that you really want to do because you have the debt in place. And so what that's really showing you is just like savings rate. It's the psychology of having a high savings rate. You're just more willing to save more when it's to free you from something that feels like a prison. Versus investing is a positive thing. You're literally growing your wealth. And there's this attitude of you can't take it with you, which obviously that's true. That's what kind of leads people to get really good with their debt pay down stories, and why people get so motivated with that. but we don't see a whole lot of people doing like $1 million Vanguard mutual fund screams out there. And why is that? It's just because it's not as emotionally gratifying. So that's why we're so focused with our advice with Student Loan Planner in developing good habits, having recurring retirement account contributions from day one, having recurring mutual fund or ETF contributions to non-retirement accounts on day one, even if you have a bunch of student loan debt. The reason is because if you want to get wealthy one day, the only way to do it is by having a high savings rate, regardless of what your student loan plan is versus whether it's forgiveness or paying it back. And viewing your finances rationally, that's how you get there. If you view your finances as sort of this thing where it's as simple as some simple, very simple kind of solution or something where you just pay down all your debt and then buy growth mutual funds or whatever. I mean, that's just not going to develop the habits that you need to develop. So this is kind of my thought process right now is paying zero on your student loans is actually a great decision, particularly if you don't have 6 months to a year in cash in the bank. If you don't have like a year's worth of cash in the bank, you've got no business putting extra money on loans right now. Okay. So get up to a maxed out retirement account and $100 a month at least into a non-retirement account just to make sure that it's set up. And then also be putting up to a year's worth of cash in the bank, plus any other short-term goals that you need to do or you want to do, like buying a house, if you want to have a down payment for a house. All those things are more important than paying extra on your student loans right now. So what if you can't pay zero? What if you have already have private loans that you refinanced, or you have private loans from school, or that you borrowed initially from school, or maybe you have some of these other kinds of loans that are held by the government. They're not held by the government. They're federal loans, but they're just not owned by the government. So these commercially held FFEL loans. So what if you can't pay zero right now? What are your options? Most private lenders are offering up to 90 days of forbearance, but you have to ask for it. So basically, you have to call your private lender or contact them via email and just ask for a 90-day forbearance. Many states, they're required to give it to you. And some states, they're not necessarily required to give it to you. But that's something that, unfortunately, the interest continues to accrue. So it's a little bit different analysis when you're looking at a private loan that continues to accrue interest. I've heard of readers right now still getting below 5% with 20-year fixed rates for people that are currently earning an income. So lenders have gotten more conservative. But say you have like a 4.5% 10-year rate and you're paying $2,000 a month on a $200,000 balance. Well, if you could do a 20-year at 4.9, that's $1,300 a month. So if you're using forbearance right now, and you have your payment that you really don't want to make right now because of cash flow reasons, that's okay. Maybe you don't do anything. Maybe you pay zero as well and you just say, I'm going to pick this back up when my dental office is open again or when my income jumps up with when I'm getting bonuses again. And that's okay to do that. But if you are running out of forbearance or you don't have that option anymore, or you just frankly want to lock in a lower amount of cash flow, it's okay to choose a very long-term refinancing deal right now. You can always, always refinance to a shorter term later. So when the economy kind of recovers somewhat and things calm down and a lot more banks and lenders re-enter the market for refinancing, and federal loans are now charging interest again, which causes even more banks to want to get in on refinancing. You can refinance from a 20-year to a 10-year or a 5-year or whatever. Our advice, again, is really rationally focused. It's not get the lowest interest rate possible, because there's things that are more important than that, like staying solvent, having money left over to invest, developing good financial habits, having a plan, not just sort of doing stuff and just hope it works out. Having a real plan where you really have step-by-step instructions of how to approach your finances to rock your finances and be, you know, able to retire and have financial freedom and all those things that people want. So if you have these commercially held FFEL loans, so let's talk about those for a second. What you have to do is just go into studentaid.gov and just see if the loans have Department of Education as the owner. You can generally see that. And then obviously, if you're still getting charged payments and interest right now that you have a loan that doesn't qualify, what you have to look at is whether or not it makes sense to consolidate to direct loans and get a 0% interest rate until September, potentially giving up some of the discounts or on-time payments that you get that lowers your interest rate. So sometimes some people out there have like 2-3% interest loans that they have special deals on from the mid-2000s. And a lot of times you have to look at the effective rate, what the real rate is versus what the rate you're getting charged is. And then you have to do some analysis to whether or not consolidating that would take that interest, lower interest number away. Basically, the short answer to commercially held FFEL loans is you need to get expert advice on it. So if you have those kind of loans from before 2010, there's definitely money to be saved. The only question is like, how should you do it and what path should you take? So we're experts in identifying those commercially held FFE loans and identifying whether or not it makes sense to pursue a consolidation or a different repayment plan on those. That was my first sort of diatribe, was talking about why paying zero makes sense for a lot of people right now, when that's contrary to what you're hearing in a lot of the advice and other personal finance content shows and things like that. The second piece of advice that I've got for you, and this is a big one, is don't worry about the amount that you borrow, which sounds sacrilegious again. I mean, it sounds ridiculous to say that you shouldn't worry about the amount of debt that you have, but that's just the reality. And the reality is that if you have federal student loans, it never matters the amount of debt that you have. You know, I don't care if you have $1 million of student loan debt. If it's all federal, there's nothing to worry about, because there's a lot of strategy that you can do and approach those loans with, and it just gives you lots of options. Now, okay, if you have private loans, should you worry about the amount you borrow? Maybe. I mean, in the sense of, if you have a good income and a good overall financial picture, which you would assume that you would, because otherwise you would not have been able to get that private loan in the first place, or at least you have a good long-term financial picture, even if you're kind of suffering right now, then you can get a 20-year term set up to lower your required payment. Try to focus on other things that can increase your income and just give you more power and a bigger shovel to pay all this debt back. If you think about it too, the worst case scenario, if you're some sort of healthcare professional with a good education and solid skill set that does a good job and people like you, your patients like you, or clients if you're in a legal field or business field, the worst case scenario is you have to maybe move to a place that actually needs your services. Maybe you live in Miami Beach and sorry, but you got to move to Fort Myers because that's where the need is. Or maybe you live in Dallas and you have to move 2 hours outside of Dallas because you can make twice as much money and you have to pay back your loans. So that's the worst case scenario, is that you have private loans that you do have to worry about what the amount you borrowed was. But for federal loans, what kind of debt, tell me, if you just pause for a second, think about this. What kind of debt can you possibly pay back as a tax? And then you pay also taxes at the end of the 20 years in the forgiven debt, obviously, if you're in the private sector. So what kind of student loan, what kind of debt out there exists where you can pay a percentage of your income? The answer, as far as I'm aware, is none. There's no debt out there that allows you to pay a percentage of your income. That is kind of a crazy concept if you think about it, because like, it's so unusual. It's so weird. I mean, that's why a lot of the family members of clients that work with us, a lot of times have their minds blown, because they just don't have any other kind of debt that's like this. You take out a mortgage, guess what? You amortize the mortgage and come up with a monthly payment that will result in full payoff after 30 years, and that's what you got to pay. And you can ask for paused payments or tell your lender you need to skip a month or something. Like, you can try to do those things, but at the end of the day, the mortgage is due. And student loan debt for federal student loans, it's just not like that at all. And a mortgage has a lot lower interest rate. Federal loans have a higher rate. More on that later. But that's just a really fascinating differentiator for student debt, which is why the amount that you borrow is not as important as you think. So think about this. With them pausing all interest and payments on federal loans, the thing I've been saying for the past year or two is that they'll probably eliminate the tax bomb at some point, and that's a lot more realistic now, just seeing the drastic action they've taken with federal student loans when they had to, right? They didn't do this because of somebody asking them for it. They did it because they felt compelled to do it, because it was an emergency. It was a problem. You really have to read a lot about what senators say, know how the Congressional Budget Office that they rely on for making legislation, they do projections. A lot of times those projections are only for 10 years. So the tax bomb for federal student loans for people in the private sector does not show up currently, because the first loan, you know, that was taken out that'd really be eligible would be the 2009 IBR loans. And then actually it'd be pay as you earn in 2011, 2012, and then add 20 years to that. That's 2031, 2032. We're living in 2020 now, so add 10 years to that, and that's 2030. That means that no forgiven student loan debt for the taxes, none of that shows up in the budget yet. And so that's why, again, Congress is just saying, well, we have other problems to worry about. We're ignoring it, which is really kind of, regardless of your political party, that's kind of how we operate in America, be it unfunded social safety net programs like Medicare and Medicaid or climate change or really just most things under unfunded pensions. Most of the problems in America, we do actually do a good job of solving them. I guess if we can solve them, I mean, that's some of the bigger questions. You wonder, okay, does something get too far gone? But like most of these problems, we do try to solve them, but we solve them when we have to. And student loan tax bombs have always been this thing that you solve tomorrow. It's just this bargaining chip that Republicans probably wanted on the table so they can negotiate something like a greater involvement in the private sector for student loan financing and probably also caps on borrowing. You know, Democrats want it on the table or don't want to push hard for it because they might have other things they're trying to push for that are more important to them right now, like healthcare or reducing income inequality or whatever their goals are. So just student loan taxation on forgiven student loan debt is just not big enough where any kind of representative or senator is willing to say, oh yeah, I'll give on this like high priority legislation I have for people in my district where I want to get this new bridge built or this new road highway bill funded in exchange for you voting yes on my student loan bill, right? Like that's kind of how that works. It's like log rolling where I'll vote for your thing if you vote for my thing. It just depends on where this stuff falls in the priority order. Those are all reasons why I think that eventually you'll see no tax bomb when the student loan debt's forgiven. And it's also why we increasingly are looking at that with clients when we're recommending whether or not they should be paying back their debt, is we run it both ways. We run the analysis with a tax bomb and without a tax bomb, and then we kind of interpret what does that mean for their own personal lives and finances. So also think about in terms of borrowing the maximum and why that's not too terrible of a thing, just to give you hope in this situation. Think about Parent Plus loans and the incentive Parent Plus borrowers have to just borrow the absolute maximum, especially if they have a big family. So think about this, okay? Just pretend that you're working class or first generation. You don't have a lot of wealth that you've saved up, either because of circumstances that have happened to you in your life that you can't control, or just because you just were raising kids, or just because you didn't really think about it or know about it. A lot of people don't get financial education. We take that for granted. A lot of us do. So say this, these people, for whatever reason, don't have very much assets and they have really smart kids they want to send to college at a top school. And let's say that also, for whatever reason, they don't get a full blank check that covers all room, board, tuition, and everything. So under the current system, one of the smartest things you can actually do is have one parent borrow the maximum for like all of their kids to send them to school and just take out the absolute max of Parent Plus loans specifically that they can get. Because then you can have that person do a double consolidation to get access to cheaper repayment options based on your income. And then you could also have that specific spouse delay Social Security to a later date to allow them to get a juiced up retirement benefit that also doesn't show up that much on their income tax returns, which lowers their required payment on their student loans. So if you're not going to be leaving much of an inheritance to your kids, what a great way to take out the absolute maximum that you possibly humanly can as a Parent Plus borrower and set the debt up to sort of die with you. And what I mean by that is you take out the max. And if, say, you take out $500,000 for four different kids or something like that combined, and you're living off Social Security, well, your payment might be like $100 a month because your Social Security income isn't 100% taxable. And also, they're giving you a deduction before they take some of it. So you might be paying $100 a month on a $500,000 loan. And if you're borrowing that at 60, then you sort of kick the can down the road till you're 85. And then rely on a disability discharge or a consolidation again to continue those $100 a month payments. And then when you pass away, that debt's forgiven tax-free. So there's another reason to borrow the max. I'll give you another one that's a little counterintuitive. What if you hated your job and you wanted to go back for a new degree? So this is something that sometimes comes up with people. Like maybe you are I've seen this for different professions. I've seen it for people who are optometrists, chiropractors, pharmacists, lawyers. Just a lot of different professions that you can think of where they went and got their initial degree and then they went back and got a second professional degree. In a lot of cases, this means that those people will end up owing, instead of 100, 200, 300, 400,000, they'll owe double that. So they'll owe $200,000 to $800,000. So that kind of a huge amount, you might say, oh my gosh, what a terrible decision. But actually, it's the rational response. So even though you have two times the debt that you would have had maybe if you'd just gone to one professional degree program, remember that the student loan debt is a tax. And if you took out all federal student loans, then you're still paying the exact same payment if you took out $200,000 or $1 million. $2 million or whatever. It's the same exact payment. The only difference is the tax bomb. Well, there's a formula that I don't want to go too crazy with this, but if you look at the math, the student loan tax bomb kind of grows at a simple rate of interest. So over 20 years, usually the amount that even if you're paying zero a month, the amount doubles over 20 years instead of over like 10, which would you would expect if it was compounding. That's just because of the way the student loan interest math works. Say the amount doubles, and then remember you're paying 40% of that. So you're paying maybe $80,000 on a $200,000 forgiven balance if you started with 100 and paid zero the whole way. And then what is $80,000 in 20 years worth in today's dollars? It might be only worth, say, maybe like $20,000 or something like that. I mean, it's really pretty small, maybe $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, something along those lines. So that means each extra dollar that you borrow might cost you like 20 cents or so in today's dollars. And that's if they charge the tax bomb. We've already talked about kind of why I think that there's a possibility that they won't. So if you hate your job and you have the ability to go back to school and get a different degree that you think you would enjoy more, and the only cost of that is obviously the years you spend in school plus 20 cents for every dollar borrowed at worst, then that's a super rational response. If student loans are a tax, then we've seen people that were making $50,000 as a chiropractor go back to nurse practitioner school and make $100,000. And that decision is a fantastic decision because student loans are a tax. And a 10% off of $50,000 is a much bigger hit than 10% off of $100,000 in terms of like quality of life. Isn't that weird? Isn't that weird? Like student loans just don't fit into any box that you would think of because there's just no restriction in the amount you can borrow at all. We're seeing also that the debt, like the normal things that would kind of make you want to borrow less, don't exist. Like when there's a really bad recession, as bad as having mass foreclosures or short sales or things like that are, one thing that it does do is it scares the heck out of people that from borrowing too much for a house the next time you have a crash, right? And what we're seeing in this current recession is I absolutely think that pausing student loan interest and payments was the right thing to do. I think also that we pushed really hard to make sure that you got forgiveness credit for those payments, those $0 a month payments, because of the perverse incentive of actually causing people to want to make payments during this time. And they were going to do a forbearance without forgiveness credit. So that was one thing that we were really glad to see it get included. I don't want to pretend that that was us specifically that got that included. It was a lot of people in the student loan sort of advocacy world that pushed for that. Even though I think that that was a good thing to do in the short term, in the long term, again, it just prevents people from having that natural crash that scares people from wanting to borrow a ton of money in the future. So not only do the current incentive structures reward people to take out the maximum possible amount once you pass like one times your expected salary when you graduate. I mean, there's not a lot of pushback on borrowing way, way more than that. Once you get up to about the same amount of debt as your full income when you're out really earning your full wage, once you get above that level, it starts to become less and less smart to try to limit the amount that you're borrowing just because of all these loopholes that exist about paying a lot less of your student loans and treating it like a tax. So that's just really kind of it's a problem because it's bad policy because there's no incentive for schools to keep costs low at all. One little story I'll give you, I just walk by this College of Pharmacy every day on the way to my office. And this College of Pharmacy a couple years ago built literally like the nicest, prettiest building I think that exists in our neighborhood, aside from like the giant building that like Microsoft works in. I mean, it's just a gorgeous building. And this gorgeous building literally houses their like student activities and recreation center. Think about that for a second. If people were given the choice of, do you want an extra $50,000 or do you want a gorgeous gym to work out in for the 4 years of pharmacy school? Every single person would say, give me the $50,000. But that's not the choice that you're given. The school goes and builds these gorgeous buildings and all of these amenities and funds it with higher tuition that's coming from unlimited student loan borrowing that's allowed because a private lender would never underwrite that. The school uses that, all those amenities, to attract more paying customers, more people willing to sign on the dotted line for unlimited student loans because of just the ability to look successful. If you look successful, look like you have amazing buildings, you think, wow, this must be a great decision going here. So that's the problem with unlimited student loan borrowing, is you're going to see more and more and more of that as schools do basically an arms race. We've got the race of the Cold War just with higher education. The schools are trying to build ever increasing levels of amenities to attract more students, which bring in even more revenue. And then that just cycle continues. And so with no ability, no incentive to keep costs low, no incentive to cap the amount that you can borrow for student loans, just students aren't going to have a huge reason to push back hard against that. So with education, I think that you can really see worse inflation than in medical prices, because at least with the medical system, the government has a lot of pricing influence with paying a specific fee through Medicare and Medicaid, which really helps set the market price for everything else in a lot of cases. With higher education, though, the government's just basically giving a blank check to every college and university that wants to set up a program, and the government's not policing how mediocre these programs are or how good they are. So you're seeing just overproduction in a lot of cases of degrees that are too expensive. Maybe not overproduction of the people that in those jobs, because a lot of those jobs are important jobs. But the reality is when you give no cap on borrowing, what happens is the kind of lower tier school that's not as high quality realizes that they can go out and build a program and charge a bunch for it, and then go spend hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars on Google ads, which is a true story, by the way. I know how Google ads work because we run them for our own business. A ton of these schools will charge a huge amount in tuition and literally go reinvest it in a lot of advertising to try to recruit new people to feed that profitability funnel, right? It's just kind of a crazy situation. And if you capped borrowing, then you would say that maybe those state universities or the lower cost universities would have more of an incentive to produce people doing the same job at a much lower cost. Anyways, continuing on this vein of why borrowing the max isn't as bad as you think, there is this New York Times podcast called The Daily. I really recommend it. It's really pretty fun to listen to. They had on a college student recently who went to a liberal arts college in kind of close to where I live. It's Haverford College. I'll just say the name because it's on The Daily. You'll figure it out. They mentioned that going to Haverford costs something like 70-ish, 72,000 a year or something like that. So you're at $300,000. Now, they would say, well, we give a lot of financial aid. Half of people are in financial aid, and a lot of the people go for free through scholarships, and we fund those through different sources, maybe from people who are able to pay full freight and everything. But even so, you're talking about a degree that's $300,000, and a lot of the people that I knew that went to Haverford, some of them go to work for hedge funds and these really, you know, high income places, and some people, it really works out where that was a justifiable expense. But think about borrowing $300,000 or just paying $300,000 to get a $50,000 to $80,000 a year corporate job, which a lot of people do. That's not worth it. I'm sorry, right? That's not worth it. The cost that they're charging is absolutely not justified with the outcome, the at least financially. Now, you might say, well, people end up getting connections. The alumni network's really valuable. But the thing is even if you borrow that amount, so for undergraduate, let's say that this person borrowed the maximum amount to go to some liberal arts college, because usually whenever somebody goes in a rant about how terrible it is colleges and universities are for charging a lot, they usually call out liberal arts colleges for maybe sometimes for like political reasons to attack the value they provide. But let's say that you did go to a liberal arts college for undergrad and you have that level of debt. You're not going to have that level of debt in your own name, because the government caps borrowing for Stafford loans at $57,500. So to borrow $300,000, the only way that happens is if your parents co-sign on a bunch of private loans for you, which no parent is going to co-sign for $200,000 for their kid. What they're going to do instead is they'll use the Parent Plus Loan Program. And the Parent Plus Loan Program allows you to pay based on your income. So that loophole of allowing you to pay based off of your income and claim most of your retirement income as Social Security income and pay almost nothing for your kid's education, that would actually be a smart thing to do, because you'd come out of that liberal arts college with maybe $40,000 to $50,000 of debt, probably have a good shot at a higher than average income coming out from an elite school versus just sort of a mediocre school. And then you're basically your parent is agreeing to pay some nominal amount of money long term in exchange for you having this awesome degree. Well, now suddenly that's worth it. That's the system that exists. So I just want you to realize that, like, so for graduate school, all the debt is in your name, because the Stafford limit is much, much higher for graduate degrees, and then Grad Plus allows you to take out an unlimited amount of money for that. So you're allowed to take out way, way, way more for graduate programs in your own name. And so then it's a lot more transparently just a tax, and you can borrow as much as you want. Again, I just don't want you to be freaked out if you owe a lot of student loan debt. I mean, that's kind of the takeaway message from this section of our show today, is just don't freak out. And so what's interesting too, is we're seeing a lot of students pushing back on the paying full freight for their education when they're getting Zoom University, right? That's kind of interesting, because if people knew like how little it mattered of the amount of debt that you have, as long as it's federal debt, maybe they would chill out a little bit and relax some more. But I mean, at least some people still care about the amount of money they're being charged. And it's a natural thing to push back against that, because it's not the same thing to get a Zoom education as it is to be in person on the campus learning from professors. So here's kind of a prediction. Why do people have such huge student loan balances? It's because universities and colleges make a ton of money and need that huge revenue to pay all of their really large expenses. They built all these new dorms, all these new amenities. They've hired all these new people. They have all these administrators. And all these people are extremely expensive. And there's a lot of jobs on the line. And so that's why these schools don't want to give back any of the money, because they're spending everything they take in. They're not really putting that much money away for rainy day. And most of the endowment funds that they have are actually pledged for specific things, like specific professorships or research projects or student scholarships. And they're not meant for operations. They're not meant to support a budget deficit for the university. So I have a little kind of provocative prediction for you. So I think that colleges and universities are going to be one of the leading proponents of reopening the economy and having live in-person classes in the fall, regardless of how conservative or liberal or politically, wherever that university falls sort of on the spectrum ideologically, or whether their leaders fall ideologically. I think that you're just going to see a lot of colleges and universities just look at their options, and the ones that really do think that we should delay reopening more, especially if we have a second wave and things get bad again, I think they'll certainly lean on the federal government to try to get a bailout. But say that doesn't happen, I think that you're going to see universities and colleges push super hard to have people on campus because of the need to get revenue to stay open. So our own research suggests that when people's finances are personally seriously threatened, that's when they change their mind on the speed of reopening in the economy and how much risk they're willing to accept personally and for their families. On average, not everybody, I'm not saying everybody, but I'm just saying on average, people's views become a lot more, let's take more risk in exchange for less financial pain when it's happening in a big way to them. And I think universities are going to start freaking out about this. And we're already seeing that at an institutional level. So just to give you an example, there was this proposal from a consortium of higher education groups. It was a letter of the who's who in higher education. There was like the American Association of Research Universities on there, Community College Association, Financial Aid Administrators Association. And they wanted the government to extend the CARES Act with some big changes. They wanted people to put in 1.5% interest rates. They wanted Congress to change the rates from what they're currently at to no payments, and add also to that no payments or interest until June 2021. Universities want to do that, and they want that. And now that would be great for you all. Don't get me wrong. Like, if that happens, like, hot dog, let's celebrate, because that would be a good thing for you. But let's look at the ulterior motives universities have suggesting that. Why do they want that? It's because they want students who are attending in the fall to not be price sensitive at all when they're sending out the bills. So if you can borrow at 1.5%, then that's a great deal. If you get no interest and no payments for even longer, that makes borrowing way less painful and way less painful to sign up for that huge bill. For example, if I get billed $10,000 for some routine procedure by my hospital, but the insurance company covers 95% of it, I don't care as much that you charged me $10,000, even though that's ridiculous. So I think that's kind of going on right now, as universities are trying to get creative for how to calm students' angst and anxiety down about the amount of debt that they're putting their students in. And their idea is, hey, let's try to distract people from what we're actually doing, which is the high cost of education causing people needing to borrow so much. If you're currently in school or know somebody that is, just realize that the universities are terrified about whether or not people are going to want gap years and not to come, or to maybe try to delay or put things off or ask for lower tuition payments. So it'll be a mess. It'll be really interesting to see. But just know, as an individual, if you have any questions about should I go and borrow another year's worth of tuition at this max level and take out all this debt, unfortunately, the answer is yes. Because again, as long as you do it in a smart way, which that's why we created the pre-debt consult, so that we could provide support for people on the front end of their borrowing and on the back end of their borrowing. We have that pre-debt consult in our Hire Us tab in the menu of our site. So we want people to borrow smart in the front end. So if you borrow smart in the front end, then you'll take out all federal loans and optimize everything and then come out at the back end. And then if you need to refinance, you will. If you need to go for forgiveness, you'll have that option. And regardless, going to college pretty much is still a great decision for most people. You will generally earn more money going to college than not. And at a very minimum, you will learn life skills, become an adult, really learn how to live. And I know that a lot of people are sort of really anti-college right now. I'm really not super among them. I mean, you could argue, well, that's because you're a self-interested jerk, Travis, because student loan planner wouldn't exist without people going to college. I don't know. Maybe that's a legitimate thing to say. But I think that the reality is just that, yes, most people shouldn't have to need to go to college to make a good living, but the rewards for information and for being the most talented and being the most educated are increasing. That's why inequality is so large. Inequality is not massive because tax rates are lower than they were in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, or because rich people are just greedier than they used to be. It's because of, I think, mostly the internet, and just the returns of being Michael Jordan are even more now than they were before his era, right? The Last Dance documentary is on, and it's on a lot of people's minds, like Michael Jordan playing for the Bulls, winning 6 NBA championships. So if you're a superstar, if you're really at the top of your field, the economic returns are so much more magnified now because of the greater reach that everyone has with the internet and with video and all these different sources of information access that people have now, right? And so that's not going to go away. That's why, like, in general, it's really good to have an education, because you are seeing a stratification of people with an education and without. So I don't know, just some thoughts there. One thing I want to tell you, some good news versus just like the Travis ranting show. So I apologize if it kind of came across that way. I just had a lot on my mind with all the stuff going on this past couple of weeks. The thing I wanted to tell you about is there will be a Treasury auction today that will probably result in record low student loan rates for next year, or at least the lowest rates there have been in 10 plus years. I'm recording this a couple days before the podcast gets released, so I don't know exactly what yield the rates are going to be at for student loans for next year, but they're going to be super low. And let me tell you how I know that's going to be happening. What you do to figure out what you're going to borrow at for the upcoming financial or academic calendar year for federal student loans is you ask yourself the question, what is the interest that the government is going to pay in May on their government bonds? So every month, the Treasury Department has an auction. Investors tell the government what interest they want to take on a bunch of extra debt. And then that's the new interest rate that is set for that particular bond issue. So just kind of think about it like you need $1 trillion and you just ask all of your favorite investor friends, okay, like I need to borrow $1 trillion. What interest rate do you want in order to give me $1 trillion? And that's how they determine what the government borrows at. So right now, the government's borrowing at less than 1% for 10-year bonds. And so probably it'll come in at about that level. Well, last time they did this formula, the government was borrowing at 2.5%. That's a lot higher. And so the government sets student loan interest by having a margin over and above what the government borrows at that they set for all of the following school year. So for Stafford subsidized loans, that margin is about 2%. So if the government borrows at 1, add 2, and then undergrads borrow at 3. And then if last year the government borrowed at 2.5, add 2. So undergrads last year and up to this spring had to borrow at 4.5. So you're going to see federal student loan interest for undergrads go from 4.5% to 3% for the coming school year. And then for graduate students, people borrowing Stafford unsubsidized loans, they're going to have their interest rate fall from about 6 to about 4.5. And then parents and graduate students that are taking out grad plus loans for expensive programs, that interest is going from 7 to about 5.5%. So this is the lowest interest has been in over 10 years. This is good news. This is going to save people a lot of money. And so at least that's happening. That's something that's positive to look forward to. And that's a that's a big difference. That's going to save people a lot of money long after the recession, because those interest rates get locked in for just the foreseeable future when they happen. So the last part of today's episode, I just wanted to kind of theorize on what this means, all this stuff means for the future of student loan policy, just because it's fun for me to do. Hopefully you can sense that it's fun and enjoy this part. So let's talk about the unintended consequences on student loan policy from this recession. I think that what we're going to see is, as smart as pausing payments was for everyone, and as generous and as happy as I am that they did that, it's going to create the expectation that the next time we have a bad recession, they're going to do the same exact thing. If you have IBR payments, one of the reasons why you have it is because if people's incomes fall, then you can pause payments. So the people that need help are getting help, and people that don't need help are still paying the loans and subsidizing the system for the people that do need the help. What we've done is created this potential expectation where when there's problems, you can just count on your student loan payment going away completely. We'll see if that happens in the future, but that kind of, to me, reinforces the need for keeping your federal loans around a little bit longer than you think you should before you refinance them, just because of the potential that Congress is going to be super generous in a time like this. The second thing is, I think all these actions make the tax bomb less likely in the future, even less likely, because if you told me at the beginning of the year that Republicans would consent to paused student loan interest and paused payments with credit towards forgiveness programs for 6 or 7 months, I would have said that's ridiculous and hilarious. They would never agree to that. That's what I would have thought, like, about somebody saying that. And then that's exactly what happened. When push comes to shove, both parties want to keep their voters, right? What matters, what this CARES Act is saying to me, is that when push comes to shove, the politicians care about the voters and getting their votes, right? Like, they don't care as much about what interest income they're going to get out of it. They don't care about profiting from the system. If they profit, it's just because it worked out that way, not because that's what they intended. That's really interesting to me, is basically saying, like, when it comes down to it, Congress is going to choose getting more voters versus, like, being careful about not getting as much money or spending too much money or something like that. So that's encouraging for any of you that have tax bombs that are worried about that. I think that's a lot less likely based off of the massive federal intervention we saw for this crisis. The next thing, and I've got, I think, five little thoughts about the future student loan policy total. So this is the third, is I think it encourages borrowers to borrow even more. The fear of debt is one thing that encourages people to be thrifty, sacrifice, go to a cheap school. But now that we have interest all paused and payments paused, and there's even more talk about, like, reducing pay as you earn from 10% to 5% of your income with Vice President Biden on the campaign trail. So I think that borrowers will be encouraged to borrow even more based off of this expectation that it's not really the kind of debt that you would think of. And they're correct. Those are rational borrowers that borrow even more because that's what the system encourages, which long term we'll see if they fix that. So the fourth thought about the future of student loan policy is that I think that it is likely that they will try to push payments lower at some point in the future. So I think the idea of, whether it's Republicans' idea of having 10% of your income go to loans but have it be a paycheck deduction, or whether it's the Democrats' idea of making pay-as-you-earn accessible to everybody instead of just some people, or whether it's Vice President Biden's idea of allowing people to pay 5% of their income instead of 10, I wouldn't be shocked if they try to create some sort of option to allow people to pay less, just because it's a way to attract support from younger voters. How do you get more people's support? Make policies that are more advantageous for them. And allowing people to pay less is certainly a policy that people will like. So I think that you'll see something like that in the future. I also think that at some point, this is probably way off still, but at some point, I think you're going to see caps on what people can borrow. It's not going to affect people going for forgiveness. It's not going to affect PSLF. It's not going to affect any of that. I think that what you're going to see is eventually, remember that 10-year look forward for the budget forecasting I mentioned? So eventually, you're going to see the CBO start to forecast all this revenue coming in from the tax bombs that people will have to pay. And then Congress is going to start realizing, maybe 10 years after that, that, hey, all this revenue that we thought was coming in from the tax bomb is actually not coming in at all. And so then we're just going to eliminate the tax bomb. And then CBO has to redo the projections at that point, showing the cost of forgiveness with no caps. And I think that Congress primarily wants to help people get college degrees that come from low-income backgrounds and protect them. I don't think that they are quite as concerned about the really high debt professional students, because it's a smaller group of the total pot. Like, there's only like a few million professional school borrowers versus like 40 million people going to undergrad only or something like that. That's kind of an interesting distinction. So I think at some point you'll see some sort of cap on the total amount that you can borrow traded for something like a no tax bomb for current borrowers, or some sort of lower payment option or something like that. So what does all this mean for your loans? Get your plan in place, because savings rate matters the most. At the end of the day, if you do all this stuff wrong, as long as your savings rate's good, that'll still get you to a good place. Know that this stuff's complicated, and the interpretation of rules and what it all means and reading the tea leaves and trying to analyze what senators are saying and what might likely get passed, and just all the different ways to pay your loans. And we just actually upgraded our spreadsheet with a new way to look at like proportional student loan payments for married couples. And it's going to be really intense and really fascinating for our consultants to have that tool to analyze how we might be able to lower people's payments even more legally using the existing rules versus any loopholes. So I'm real excited about that. So this stuff is just super complicated. Like, every time I think I know everything about student loans, I find out a new layer that makes it even crazier, which is partly why it makes it so much fun to just sit here and talk to you about it. We stay on top of this stuff daily. So in addition to the math and rules knowledge, you get that expertise when you work with us, in addition to if you work with me and my corny jokes. So I will say that a lot of the conversations I'm having right now with people are becoming a lot more money coaching flavored. Like, how do you compare to your peers in terms of your income? How are you affected by the recession right now? What are you doing? What do you need to adjust? Is there anything about your student loans to adjust? What's your long-term plan for your student loans? And we've got a lot of data to compare people to now that we have about 4,000 clients. So that's been something that's been pretty useful, I think, just to be able to tell somebody, hey, you're kind of below trend for what your income should be based off of you living in this particular metro area. You might want to reach out to a CPA or lawyer or something and have a look at your contract or your, you know, location or your whatever it is. We're a lot more knowledgeable than just student loans, because everyone that works with us has got some sort of advanced credential or CPA, CFP, CFA kind of thing. So we have a lot of expertise about other things, even though we focus on student loans, try to be the best in the world at that, because ultimately what we care about is holistic financial health. If you come to us and you have an awful problem with some bad financial product that you bought, we're not going to go cross the line and give advice that would cause us to need to be regulated, because that's what allows us to charge a few $100 for our consults. But we're going to go up to that line and try to make sure that you get connected with one of the good people out there that can help fix a major problem that you have with some other area of your financial life. So that's been really fun to look more and more at that, as this crisis has just brought out all kinds of weird stuff in people's lives. And last little thing, I wanted to announce a really cool thing that I think a lot of you will be excited about. Student Loan Planner is certainly taking a big hit, especially with our advertising revenues and refinancing student loans revenues, which are down a lot. But we still have a lot of you that are continuing to book consultations. And I really appreciate you valuing our advice and our methodologies and our expertise that much. I really do appreciate it. And to give back to you and our community, we're going to be doing the Student Loan Planner 2020 Scholarship again this year. Not only are we doing it again, we're going to be expanding the number of scholarships that we're giving away. Last year, we gave away 15, and we had a bunch of different categories in that. And this year, my goal is to increase that to as many as 20 scholarships. We're going to give a scholarship to a lot of different categories of jobs and professions. We're also going to give one specifically designated to frontline workers that worked with COVID-19 patients. We're going to give a scholarship to non-healthcare workers that were essential frontline workers, like grocery store, security, some sort of essential frontline worker that was getting exposed, potentially serving the public that has student loans. And those scholarships are going to be $500 plus enrollment in our investment course for free, which is a $400 value. And then the top three people that enter also get a student loan plan on top of that, which brings the total value of the scholarship to as much as $1,500. So I'm excited about that. It's going to obviously take money out of my pocket to give it back to our community, but that's part of our goal being a mission-driven company, is to try to help everybody out there. And what I'm hopeful for is We do have like this essay contest as part of it. So I'm excited to kind of ask, how do people fare financially during the coronavirus pandemic, and what lessons did you learn? That's going to be real fun to do that scholarship again this year. We're going to announce that later in June, and we're going to start accepting applications for that probably in mid to late July. So I'll keep you posted on that. Thank you so much for listening to this podcast. I couldn't do this without you. And honestly, thank you very much for all the people who've already worked with us. Thank you for being a client. Please tell your friends about us. And if you have not worked with us yet, we are now the highest rated company in the student loan industry. We have an average rating, if you round up, I think if you round up 4.96 to 5 stars, then we're rated 5 stars out of 5 on almost 500 reviews. So that's kind of, I think, unheard of, because I take it personally when we don't have a good outcome, when we don't have a good student loan plan that happens. Like, we approach it as if it was like a disaster, because I'm relentlessly focused at just being this place that you trust for student loan expertise that's just better than anything else you could possibly get. So thank you so much for everybody, all the clients that rated us like that, and then also the people that have yet to work with us. Thank you for considering it. So you can go to studentloanplanner.com/help if you're interested in working with us. We also do follow-up consults if you've already worked with us, if you have a lot of questions with the kind of the pandemic and your finances right now. And lastly, don't forget studentloanplanner.com/voicemail if you want to ask a question to appear in a future podcast episode. Thanks for listening, and stay safe out there.